So last week we introduced Tzuras HaPesach.
Okay, I assume around, you know, an hour 20.
Okay, fine. In terms of the practical issues in Tzuras HaPesach, really, they mostly revolve around the question, as I mentioned last time, two questions, right? One is, to what extent does a Tzuras HaPesach need to mimic an actual Pesach? That is usually introduced with a machlokas between Rov HaPoskim and the Nesivos in his Makor Chaim. The Gemara in two places, in Erevin Yud Aleph and in Menachot Laman Gimel, introduces an invalidation of a Tzuras HaPesach, which is called Pischei Shimoi, which the Gemara itself has a machlokas, what exactly it means, whether it means Deleslu Shakfe or Deleslu Tikra, and even within Deleslu Shakfe, you have a machlokas Rishonim of what exactly that means. We'll come back to that in a second. Now, the simplest read of the Gemara in both places is that this is relevant for two areas of halacha. One is mezuzah, in terms of what type of doorway do you require mezuzah, and what is not considered a doorway for that purpose. That's clearly the context in Menachot. And in Erevin, the simplest understanding of the sugya is that it's about Tzuras HaPesach of Erevin, and that's how Rov HaPoskim understood it. Despite that, the Nesivos... All right, can you take Ezra? All right. Can you take Ezra? It wasn't locked. Ezra, you can say hello for a second, and then say bye. Yeah. I go to Ema, Ezra. Okay. Now, the Nesivos argues...
Jonathan, I'm in pajamas. I need you to take them out.
Hi. Sorry about that. The Nesivos claims that it's not true. Right? He claims that fundamentally it's only mezuzah that needs a Tzuras HaPesach, really, a real Tzuras HaPesach, because you're looking for a doorway, pshuto kimashmao, and therefore anything which is not a perfect doorway is going to make it that it doesn't require a mezuzah. But he argues, and again, there are textual problems with this issue, especially the context in the Gemara and Erevin, where it makes it clear that this seems to be about. It seems to be about Erevin as well, but he claims that it's not true, that you don't need it, because he assumes that Tzuras HaPesach is not really a doorway, right? It's a symbolic doorway which functions halachically for the purpose of Erevin as a doorway, but you don't actually need a door, which is quite a chiddush, isn't usually not accepted lahalacha by itself. Though it is accepted by some poskim as a snif lahakel, so some of the poskim who are more makel on some of the issues we're about to talk about will bring as a snif lahakel the claim that, well, all these, you know, problems in doorways are not really problems in Erevin. There is a nice piece in the Chicago book. In the back they have Biurim, where they just analyze this position of the Sivos if you're interested in looking at it more. Now, like I said, the majority of poskim don't accept that straight. They assume that, look, a Tzuras HaPesach has to mimic a doorway. Even if it's not really functioning as a doorway, it has to be a doorway. It has to function that way. And therefore, anything which structurally or location-wise would make it that this doesn't make sense conceptually to call this a doorway, they will invalidate that and claim that that doesn't work for Tzuras HaPesach. The other issue is simply the textual one, is that the one thing we know for sure about a Tzuras HaPesach is that it's a kana mikan of a kana mikan of a kana al gabehen. Right? That's the description of it. So even if you bought the Nesivos' conceptual argument, a Tzuras HaPesach is still going to have to fit that basic linguistic formulation, that it has two posts on the side and a post on top, which is going to also explain a lot of the invalidations that you get. So just to sort of run through a few of the types of issues that come up, I'm going to hopefully we'll see if you can get some of these pictures. I'll try to put it at the screen and see if they are clear. Though I don't know if they will be. Okay. Here I happen to think, and I know I've mentioned this book several times, but here I do think that the book from Chicago is worth having. It just, the pictures are qualitatively better, and they help you understand what's going on. So like I said, the types of invalidations that you have that will make something not door-like. So one could be simply in the structure, right? If something doesn't look like a doorway, so it's not a doorway, so it's not going to work. Now the Gemara, the invalidation halacha is referred to as a tzuras ha-pesach min hatzad, right? That's one of the invalidations. But it's not exactly clear what exactly tzuras ha-pesach min hatzad is, right? That's clearly a structural concern, right? Something doesn't look like a doorway, but it's not clear exactly what that means. And there's a lot of machlokas in the poskim of what type of tzuras ha-pesach that is going to invalidate. So here, let me try to get a picture here. So this is a sugya in Erevin Yud Aleph, right? Tzuras ha-pesach min hatzad is invalid. Now the poskim argue about exactly what this means. But it is a case where the crossbeam doesn't lie perfectly on top of the side posts. Now it could be, the post can basically discuss two reasons why this is invalid. One is because it's not domed at Tzuras HaPesach. The other, as I mentioned textually, is that a Tzuras HaPesach has to be kana mikan, 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 mikan al gabehen. And once you get a Tzuras HaPesach which is slanted, so you can't invoke good asik for the Tzuras HaPesach. Because normally, a Tzuras HaPesach, even if it's kana mikan vekana mikan vekana gaven, it doesn't have to be perfectly attached. It could be above, and you can rely on good osik. Once something is slanted, you can't rely on good osik. Now, how demanding we are about that is not exactly clear, and you get all types of different formulations. You're not going to be able to see these pictures. But basically, what?
Try one more time.
I'll see if I can try to get the pictures. These might be small on the Zoom screen. But here, a classic one of Tzuras HaPesach min hatzad. So, one example of a Tzuras HaPesach min hatzad is simply going to be you have the two kind of like this. If you attach the cross beam not on top, but here, right, like in the middle, right, that's going to be a problem because no doorway looks like that. And if you put it on top, so then that obviously is a classic Tzuras HaPesach. Now, a similar type of machlokes is a slanted Tzuras HaPesach. For similar reasons, right? A normal Tzuras HaPesach would not be slanted, right? It would be straight, right? Normal Tzuras HaPesach are perfect rectangles. A slanted one doesn't obviously look like a doorway. So the poskim argue is that similar to Tzuras HaPesach min hatzad, right, where the crossbeam is not attached to the top, that's going to invalidate it. Here you basically have three deot in the poskim. Rebbe Yashiv and others claim that a Tzuras HaPesach needs to be perfectly rectangular, right? It has to be perfectly, perfectly straight. The side beams have to be it just has to be at 90 degree angles. It has to be perfectly rectangular. Otherwise, like a Tzuras HaPesach min hatzad, structurally, it doesn't look like a Tzuras HaPesach, and therefore it's going to be invalid. And as they record that Eiruvin, in certain communities that didn't fit those standards, when Eliyashiv heard about it, he would actively go to them, tell them that their Eiruv is invalid. The stipler felt that way as well. The Rav Aaron Cutler, and this seems to be the position of the Mishnah Berurah as well, and Shin Samach Gimel Yud Aleph, argues that this is not true. He argues that what you need is simply that the top, right, al-gabe'en, at the very top, the cross beams have to be placed underneath, the side beams have to be placed underneath the cross beam, but after that, as long as it's under the cross beam, they can slant. And the Eruv in Lakewood, when Rav Aaron Cutler was there, was in fact with slanted Eruvin, as long as the cross beam was placed over the sides, like the top of the side beams. After that, if it slanted, it was not a problem. Rav Moshe argued that the side posts do need to be placed under the cross beam, but they don't have to be straight, and you can have a small slant of less than 3 tvachim. That was Rav Moshe's position. Now, the Chazon Ish suggested, though not lemaisa, but conceptually, that there should be a difference, right? If you think that the issue of a slanted Tzuras HaBezach is not that it doesn't look like a doorway, but that it doesn't fit kana mikan al-gabehen, so he says, well, if the side posts go like this, right, they curve out, right, so that's invalid because the cross beam is going to be over nothing. But if it goes like this, the angle curves so that all the side beams are under the cross beam, right? They angle in, right? So then it would be kasher because it would fit kana mikan v'kana mikan v'kana al gabehen because they are underneath the air. Lemaisa, he didn't love it, but as a conceptual possibility, he does raise this. This is in Hilchos Eruvin. This is in Sifkatan Yud Aleph in his piece on Eruvin. Now the Pischei Shimai issue, right? The disfigured Eruv, essentially. Like I said, there are different cases that it could be. Some Rishonim assume that what it means is where the side beams are made up of misaligned bricks. If you can see this picture, I don't know if this is clear at all. But basically, right, it doesn't look like a doorway. It looks like, you know, you sort of carved out, you have like a brick wall and then you carve out a hole in it. So there's just like random juts, right? There isn't like a clear doorway. So that's how many Rishonim understand the problem of Pischei Shimoi. Now, not everyone understands it that way, but Rav Moshe argued Baal Peh, that even if you didn't accept that definition of Pischei Shimai, you know, the Tzuras HaPesach does have to be somewhat shaped like a doorway, right? It can't be totally, right, it can't look totally not like a doorway, because that would invalidate kana mikan v'kana mikan v'kana al-gabehen. So exactly how unstraight it can be is, you know, different shitot have different positions, but like Rav Moshe invalidated, if you can see the second picture here, right, where the side beam just looks twisted, right, that Rav Moshe argued that according to everybody, again, so everyone agrees that it needs to somewhat resemble a doorway, and even if it doesn't have to resemble a doorway, it does need to fit the linguistic formulation of kana mikan v'kana mikan v'kana al-gabehen, and therefore, if it's too egregious, so then it is it's going to be invalid. The poskim argue about slanted cross beams. Right? What happens if you have the side posts of unequal heights, and then you have a sloped cross beam? So the Magen Avraham, and this is in Shin Samach Beis Yud Ches. All these sources are on the source sheets, but Ray Zimmerman told me to do this outside, so I'm going to just talk outside. Argues that they don't have to be actually equal in height. It's not a problem to have a slant. But Rabbi Akiva Eiger argues it's not true. Rabbi Akiva Eiger argues that if you have a short crossbeam and then a tall crossbeam and then a short side beam and then a tall side beam and the cross beam then goes at an angle, that is pischei shimoi, right? Structurally, that doesn't work. Some achronim invalidate it. Not because it's pilkei shimoi, but because they think it doesn't fit kana mikan v'kana mikan v'kana al gabayan, and they say what it is instead is kana echad b'shamayim v'kana echad ba'aretz, and therefore it seems to not fit this. The poskim. Argue about exactly if you want to invalidate the slant, how slanted it would have to be. Now, Rav Aaron Cutler argues that even according to the Magen Avraham, that you're allowed to have a slight slant, you can't have a 45-degree slant, because once you get past 45 degrees, it becomes a Tzuras HaPesach Min Hatzad, because the slant is so severe, right, that it's no longer a kana mikan v'kana al gabehen, right? The second, right, the angle has made it that it basically looks like it's attached to the side, like it's no longer on top. Rav Aaron Cutler argues that that even the Magen Avraham, who allows a slight slant, would invalidate it once it hits the 45 degrees. There is a bit of a machlokas in the poskim, though, if the crossbeams is aligned perfectly over the side posts, but the side posts are of varying heights. So that would happen if you had, let's say, a mountain, right? And you make a Tzuras HaPesach over a mountain. So then the Tzuras HaPesach, right, looks perfectly rectangular, but the problem is not on the slope of the cross beam, but on the varying angles of the side beams. That might be less problematic because there it does in the end create a Tzuras HaPesach. One of the biggest machlokot in the poskim is tachuv, right, the description of the Tzuras HaPesach, as I said, is Tzuras is kana mikan v'kana mikan v'kana al gabehen. So clearly from its side, if you attach it to the side, that's a Tzuras HaPesach min hatzad, that's invalid. But if you put it in, right, betachuv is where you drive the Tzuras, the kane, right, the cross beam, not, you don't tie it to the side of the beam, but you drill it into the beams itself. This is a big machlokas poskim. I gave you in 31, Rabbi Jachter summarizes this in terms of modern poskim, and he notes that Rabbi Eider and Rabbi Heinemann don't rely on tachuv in their Irvin. Rabbi Schechter, Rabbi Willig, both think that tachuv can be relied on. And practically, if you look at many of the Irusvarim, they just say that, whatever it says on paper, the majority of city Erevin do rely on tachuv, especially those that rely on telephone poles. It's just easier sometimes to just drill into the side of the side posts. I gave you that if you look in 31, right, Jachter. Before that is sort of the classic poskim. But that's one of the major machlokot that you get. Another major machlokot you get in terms of the structure is when you put the kana mikan, v'kana mikan, v'kana al gabehen, how do we define that it is al gabehen? Do you do it by eyesight or plumb line, right? Meaning, is it that, right, when you look at the Tzuras HaPesach, it has to look like there's two side posts and then there's a cross beam on top? Or does it have to be that you actually have to measure it? And it physically has to be on top, regardless of how it looks.
So plumb line, if you look up, plumb line is an older terminology. It's called now, if you look on Wikipedia, it's called a plumb bomb. But what it basically is something that you just drop from the top, and it's very, it's like a level, but for vertical. Meaning a level, if you're building something, you want to make sure that something is level, so you have a little thing. Here it's just something you push down from the top. It has like this little, you know, like a metallic type of arrow at the end, and that will tell you exactly where something is vertically.
Out of curiosity, well, based on what you said previously, seemingly by having that sort of petach not over the top but drilled into the side, there's definitely what to be sumach on with that. Why is it then that the army, and if I recall, Rav Yirmonon is in Hilchot Tzeva also, and the army's psak for sure, they're incredibly machmir on that. If there's really what to be sumach on, I know that the army makes a very big deal about that with Erevin, particularly with Shetach and the Erkot Eruv that they give out to Chayalim and Shetach. They're always very machmir on making sure that happens.
Look, there definitely are poskim who are machmir on it, right? This is not like a new machlokas. I just sort of jumped to the halacha l'maisa there. I mean, look, I gave you right jachter's practical to just tell you that in right, you know, just to see that l'maisa, many of the you know, Irvin that I assume many of you have carried in, right. Right, according to Rai Jachter, both the Tinek and the Englewood Erev rely on right on Tachol. Right, these are right. So I can't speak for why the army is machmir. There are obviously poskim that are machmir. Right, Heinemann is machmir in America, so I assume that means the Baltimore Erev is machmir on it. Many Meridier Erevin are not. Right, I can't tell you why.
I'll tell you, Brother Aaron, on Sunday night we'll hear from someone in the army about making Erevin in the army, so he'll be good to answer that question.
It's not as much of it's more just a curiosity.
Yeah, then that's the thing you'd have to ask.
There's definitely what to be said about.
Practical. Even posting, you know, every year they try to improve the Tinek Erev. Tinek Erev has big Rabbanim, has Rabbi Jachter, it has Rabbi Savolovsky. You know, big rabbanim in the area, every year they go on that tour with this Rav Micha, and they try to up at least one thing in an Eruv. The one thing is, practically, when you build an Eruv in a city, part of the goal is to build as little as you need to use whatever is there, because chances are whatever you could build is not as strong to weather the elements as, you know, other stuff. When you're building an Eruv in the army, and if you're building it, chances are you're building it for one Shabbos. So there are certain things that are easier to be machmir on, and you know, building it in a city, telephone lines are a gift. In many European cities now, all the telephone lines are going underground, which are making Erevin extremely, extremely difficult. They were already difficult in Europe, but making it even more difficult. So there, you know, you deal partly with what you have. So I think that's part of it.
Yeah, I mean, look, also, the Svara of Tachov is a good logic, right? Meaning, the Svara of Tachov is basically, right, so the simplest Svara is just that, look, it is Kan Al Gabehen, right? Meaning, if I took a doorway, and I put side beams and a cross beam, and then on top of the cross beam I built something, right, then it would still be a, right, it doesn't remove the fact that there's a cross beam on top of the side beams, right? So the Achronim, you can look. Notice the Kelim on Shulchan Aruch. I just sort of jumped to Halacha L'maaseh, but it's the previous sources here, right? They just argue. Look, in the end of the day, Tachov is just like it's as if I built a doorway, and then I just built on top of the doorway. What's the problem, right? I mean, Tachov is a very right logically makes a lot of sense. It's just right, basically arguing like, so what? So I built beyond where I put the crossbeam, but who cares, right? In the end of the day, there is a kana on top of the side beams. It's just that I built beyond that. I gave you in 33, right, Jack, there's a summary of the plumb line, plumb bomb, whatever it's called now, or eyesight. Right, now we paskin, in number 32 there, that, right, the Gemara asks of whether tzrichin ligo or, ein tzrichin, liga, right, does the cross beam and the side beam, do they actually have to touch? Which presumably is some machlokas about how much is this a real Erev and how much is it a formal Erev, or how seriously do we take good asik, right, or some machlokas along those lines. We paskin, like Rav Nachman, that it doesn't have to touch. But he does have to rely on Gudasik. And you see here, right, that you get, in just in terms of the modern poskim that, right, Jachter quotes, the Rav, Moshe Feinstein, thought that Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, Rav Gedalia Schwartz, all think that you're allowed to use eyesight. On the other hand, you get Rav Yitzchak Libes, Rav Bleich, Rav Feivel Cohen, Rav Moshe Heinemann, Rav Schechter, Rav Willig, who all think that it has to be, you have to actually measure it. Certain poskim think that it's better to do it right perfectly, but if it's impossible to build an Eruv without it. So that was a position of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, right? He told Rav Jachter, this is Alpeh, that he'd rather it be plumb line, but if it's impossible to do it without using eyesight, so then you should, then you can use eyesight. And then if you look in the continuation of Rav Jachter's piece, right, he notes that in the 70s and 80s, when he started building Eruvin, he asked Poskim from Europe, where they also quoted that this machlokes existed in Europe, and he talked to Rav Goldwicht, who said that in Israel as well, different Eruvin rely on different things. So this is right. So this is not a new machlokes. Okay. At the end, on number 34, I gave you, right, another example of an Erev that's not going to work. That's sort of a trapezoidal Erev. This is from Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Like I said, there are many, many, many different variations of these problems that go under structure. There are a bunch of invalidations of Tzuras HaPesach that rely not on structure, but location. So, for example, if you have an Erev, if you have a one side of the kana within a rishus hayachid and the other one outside, should the poskim invalidate that? Because many poskim invalidate, not all. Many poskim invalidate that because they assume that the rishus hayachid. First of all, that's not how you make doorways, right? So it's lo avdi inshe. And the second problem is that the rishus hayachid becomes right, like it's filled, right? Rishus hayachid is keman demalia damya. So halachically, it makes it as if it disappears. So many poskim do not like Tzuras HaPesach where one of the kana is within a rishus hayachid. There are poskim that right. If you want to, I put Makaros on this, but if you want a nice summary of it, right, Simon has a summary on this in on page Kuf Lamed Bet, the Tzuras HaPesach Shekana Echad Omeid Betoch Rosh HaYachid O Achorei Kotel, right? And there he notes that the poskim who invalidate it, either invalidate it because the Rosh HaYachid makes it that it doesn't exist, or it doesn't. Right, or it's not the way people make doors. He notes that there's a third group of poskim who don't like it because they argue that Tzuras HaPesach also needs to have a din heker, even though normally heker is what we associate with lechi and kaneh. A lechi and a korah. Some poskim require it for Tzuras HaPesach as well. So the majority of poskim don't like it, either for one of those reasons. It's not a heker, it's a siluk mechitzos, and the like. But there were poskim who defended it. I talked at some point to the rabbi who built the Erev in Winnipeg with the Nite Gavriel and with the Mishnah Halachot, and there he said they did actually have some of the Tzuras HaPesach that were in fenced areas, and they felt they poskin like the Achronim who thought that was not a problem, but the majority of poskim seemed to not like it. You get similar machlokot of Tzuras HaPesach over Mayim. Right, if you have a Tzuras HaPesach over Mayim, does that work? Right, or right, even though the Tzuras HaPesach is perfect, right, is that the way you build a doorway? Right, nobody builds a doorway over water. Right, it's not practical. So many poskim don't like that. The same rabbi told me that in Winnipeg they had certain tours of Pesach that, at least at some point, did go over water. So there are poskim who are makil on that. So again, you get. So that's, if I said this, sort of the second category of invalidations that you get at Tzuras HaPesach, right? The first one are structural issues. The second type of machlokas you get is location issues, right? You could also look at that as not as much location as context, right? Right, meaning the water one, it could be in a fine place, it's just that, right, both the kanes are in perfectly normal places to have a Tzuras HaPesach, but contextually this doesn't look like a Tzuras HaPesach because, right, no one's going to walk through it, right? It's not that there's, you know, it's not like the over water is slightly different than the one that's in it, that's behind a wall, right? Where the one behind a wall in Rosh Hashanah that has problems with the actual side post, right? With the kane. The one that's over water, the side post is fine. The side post is fine. The crossbeam is fine. But you look at it contextually, like no one builds a doorway in this way, and that, therefore, for many post-game is a problem. Again, you will find interesting kula that certain people will rely on. Okay, I'm going to adjust for a second. Let me get you a few pictures. Yeah, they also have it, right, pictures like this, if you can see, right, where you have one of the Tzuras HaPesach is within a wall. I don't know if you can see that picture, right, but one of them is inside a wall, one side is outside the wall. They also know that not all poskim invalidate that, but many poskim do. They quote this from Rav David Sukkar, Shlomo Miller in the Toronto era of invalidates that. As well, right, they have the pictures of the Tzuras. That's just Me'achorei Kotel, non-Rosh HaYachid. Then they have all these variations of Tzuras HaPesach in Rosh HaYachid, right, where it goes under a house. So it's not Me'achorei Kotel, but it is under a roofed part of a building. I'm just going to quickly turn towards their pictures. Yeah. I'll take maybe a few more minutes on this. Just to show you this type of, they have, hopefully you can see some of these pictures. Yes, you have, here. Some machloko that they have, what if you have a two-pieced Tzuras HaPesach like this, right? On the one hand, it looks like it should be kosher because, right, it's rectangular and the crossbeam is over a vertical element. On the other hand, right, it's not over the majority of the vertical element. If you can see that on your screen, should be the right-hand side, I think, as it's coming up, right? But over here, right, you get, right, it's a two-pieced Tzuras HaPesach. So that is a machlokes. They note here that on the one hand, right, it is economy kan al gabayan, on the other hand, it's cut off the majority of the crossbeam, so you could argue that maybe that is a Tzuras HaPesach min hatzad.
Let me just add one thing. I'll just add, if you got a chance to look at what the stuff I sent from Rabbi Jachter, even the first parts, Rabbi Jachter just makes a very important, you know, he said in an ideal world, you wouldn't have an Eruv, except if it's built where the Rav is a real Talmid Chacham who understands Eruvin, where you have it built by an expert in Eruvin, and even where you educate the community to notice certain issues, because a lot of these issues, you'll say, okay, it's not really an issue because when we build the Eruv, we're going to deal with all these issues, we're going to solve all the issues. Things change, right? Even one of the things that Rabbi Jachter writes there is the reason Rabbi Heinemann is makbid that the even though it's unnecessary, al pidin shulchan aruch, but that the lechis actually go all the way up to the crossbeam, you know, the reason why he's makrif for that is he noticed that once you build an Eruv, you know, on electric poles, at least in Baltimore where he is, there's a difference between the poles, you know, the poles in the winter and the poles in the summer because the ground contracts. And because of that, the shape actually changes. So you could build all these things in a great way, and then you could find that things change. And a lot of what you're looking for is, number one, to be aware of the basic issues, but also to be able to notice when things are, you know, when things are built, even if they're built properly, what happens to them. Something like, you know, the picture Rabbi Zirin just showed, that picture is also, that's something that could happen over time, that there could be a break in something that, you know, it can initially have been built properly, but now it's essentially in two separate pieces. So can you just, you know, put it back together in a way like that or not? So these are, again, you know, these are things that to be aware of in general, even though some of the let's call mitiniyut issues of what exactly you're going to do in building the Eruv, that's going to be done in a lechatchila manner.
Now I just mentioned that a lot of what they do in Erevin when they're building on the telephone poles is when the telephone pole doesn't fit the proper structure or they can't manage to get the cross beam on top of the telephone pole, what they do is in many of them, right, they rely on Godasik, right? What they do is they put like a tubing, like a plastic tubing on the side of the telephone pole. Right, and then they attach the Eruv, right, the cross beam of the Tzuras HaBezach, not over the telephone pole, but good usik over the sort of tube or stick that they attached to the side of the telephone pole. Right, so it would be tachov within the telephone pole, but actually halachically it's not tachov because the actual kana is not what you think the kana is. Right, it's the little tiny tube that they've attached to the side of the pole, so that is another way that they solve it. Now, a lot of sort of other practical issues that come up with that, as Ezra mentioned, you just need to be able to look for these things. You know what you're looking for is what happens if it's on a telephone pole and it's placed, let's say, even on the top or above the tube that you put on the side, but then they add a utility box in the middle, right? So now there's a hefsek between your side beam, right, on the bottom of the telephone pole and the string. So does that create a hefsek? So Ray Miller, for example, Shlomo Miller in Toronto, thinks that that's a hefsek, and now the whole thing is invalid. David Feinstein thinks it's not, right? He thinks as long as the Tzuras HaBezach, as long as the kana is physically below the, right, so you have this picture over here. Right, if you can see, right, you have the side beam, and then you have this utility box, right, and then they attach it over here. So Ray Miller invalidated that in Toronto. David Feinstein thinks that's totally fine, right? So you get all types of variations along that. Now you could also actively use the utility box if it is the right size, in which case then you would be right. If you have a tall and wide one, you could potentially use that to be your kana, right, you have over here, right, in this picture. Right, so being able to see things like that and know what you're doing is also important. I mentioned before the uneven terrain issues, right? Now here they have, if you just want to see a bunch of ways that this could happen, right, so you have like this picture, right, where you have a mountain, right, part of it on a mountain, part of it in the valley, but you could get it, right, they have a bunch here, right, you could have it that it's attached to a, like a wall in a park, you could get things like this, right, over roads that are built lower than the, right, those like highways, right, or just roads where you have sort of inclines on the side, right, they're all different places where you might have terrain issues like that. And again, that's where you have Machlokot HaPoskim, right? They have here the picture of the Tzuras HaPesach over water, which is a, as I mentioned, is a Machlokes like that, right? You could have it in over a small stream. You have questionable issues if you have one like this, right? Where it goes through a tree, right? Right? All these different types of things Our machlokot haposkim, right? What if it goes over a house like this one, right? Like I said, right? There are many, many different manifestations of it, and you really need to sit down with one of these books and just go through every single one. Like I said, my favorite, and I'll end with this, like I said, is this Chicago book because, again, personally, right, I read a lot of these things, I don't know what they're visualizing. They took a lot of these pictures and just took them to Poskim and said, okay, look, this is the type of thing that happens in a community Erev, what do you think? And then they just list for you, right? Miller says it's fine, or David Feinstein says it's not fine, you know, this Posing says it's fine, this Posing says it's not fine. But as I started at the beginning, right, they all really come down to three issues, right, or four issues, right? One is simply, is it defined as kana mikana 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 al gabe? And the second is, assuming you don't accept the Nesivos Makor Chaim's claim, and you think that a Tzuris HaBezach does have to look like a door, so that has all types of structural implications, location implications, and contextual implications, right? And all these million variations are all, you know, variations on a theme. Of does that make it domet to a doorway or not? And you have sort of just different machlokot on each issue. Hopefully, in the practical one, it'll explain some of them, you know, more of them. But you really, you know, it takes half an hour to just sit with the chapter that Rai Bechofer has in his book, or the chapter that they have. They have two chapters in the Laws of an Erev book, and just see what all these things really look like l'maisa. Okay. Quickly, a few of the other issues. One of the banes of any person who builds an Erev, the banes of their existence is Karpef. Karpef, very, very, very quickly, I sent you Ray Simon's shir with his 42-page Makoros packet, you know, with everything underlined you know, arrows and etc. It's like a 45, maybe an hour shir, I'm not, 45-minute, an hour shir, something like that. You know, the conceptual issues are pretty straightforward as things go. The practical issues are much more problematic. So a karpef is basically like this. Right? An Erev is meant to enclose a place where people live. If you have a place where people don't live, then that is conceptually anathema to an Erev. And that is what we call a karpef. Right, a karpef, as the Rambam summarizes it in Perek Tet Zayin of Hilchos Shabbos, is makom shelo hukaf ledira, ela sheyeh tashmisho la'avir. Right, it's a place that's just not for living; it's just la'avir. Kigon ganot pardesim, kigon amakif makom in aret l'shamro v'chayotze behen. Right, so all these things, right. If you, he continues, he said, if they have mechita, im yesh begova mechita, asar tzvachem, oh yes, arei kershus hayachid l'chayev, hamotziv azorik v'hamoshiv imenu l'shus harabim, right? Technically, on a d'oraisa level, this is a reshus hayachid, if you put walls around it. But, in metaltlin bekulo, elem ken yesh bo beis l'sayim opachos, but halacha l'maisa, you aren't allowed to carry in these spaces, unless they are less than the size of a beis l'sayim. If they are larger than the size of Beis HaSayim, so then they invalidate the Eruv because they're a makom which is not Dira, and therefore they don't make sense in a place which is meant to sort of be a huge house, right? If an Eruv is meant to be a big house where people live, right, this is not a house. How big is Beis HaSayim exactly? So Ray Jachter gives you the summary, right? This is part, Ray Simon gives you the summary, right? This is a function of how big you think, right, in general, Amodar, right? The numbers come out, Lemaisa, to Reb Chaim Noah thinking that it's 157, let's see, sorry, it's 15.7 feet is 10 amos, so 157 amos, 50 amos, 78.5 years, okay, it's 12,324.5 square amos, according to Reb Chaim Noah's calculations, which is a square of 101, about 101 feet by 101 feet, right? That's not so big. According to Rav Moshe, you're talking 15,664.5 square feet, which is a square of 125.158 by 125.158. And according to Chazon Ish, you're talking 17,465 square feet, which is about 132 feet by 132 feet. You're not talking huge, right? If you think about how small that is. So that is why Karpeif really creates such a problem, because a Beis HaSayim Shel Hukaf Ladira, which is found in the middle of an Eruv, can invalidate the entire thing. Now, there is a shita that is used as a sniff lahakel, which is the Dvar Shmuel's shita, which is quoted by the Ber Halacha in Siman Shin Nun Ches. So this is the Dvar Shmuel in Siman Resh Nun Tet, where he argues that a Karpeif does not invalidate a city. It only invalidates a smaller Eruv, but if you have an ear, Hamukaf al Choma, so then a Karpeif does not invalidate the Eruv. And the argument in that the Poskim explain is basically, look, when you have a smaller Eruv, like a Chatzer or something, and you have a Karpeif, so you can't look at that and say that it's a Makom Dira. But a city, right? Basically, a city sometimes includes, you know, a big city can be pachor yoter ledira, and then there's a space here and there, right? That is not, like, that's just how cities are, right? You walk around, you know, Manhattan is ledira, but, like, there's a construction zone here, there's a weird zoning issue there, right? So the Dvar Shmuel's argument is that basically these invalidations of Karpeif are in smaller areas, in a chatzer, but if you actually have a city, so then we're more makel. When you have an ear which has chomot, so then we're going to be makel. Right? The way the Chacham Tzvi, and the Chacham Tzvi, right, clarifies this in Siman Nun Tes and his Tshuvot, that seems to be what the Dvar Shmuel is thinking, right? Is that when you have a city, it is a makom dira, no matter how you look at it. Now, whether we paskin like it is a different question, right? The Chacham Tzvi very vehemently pushes back on the Dvar Shmuel. Most poskim will not rely on the Dvar Shmuel by itself, though it will often be brought in as a sniff lahakel, right? As a sniff lahakel. So, for example, they write in the Laws of the Eruv book that they talked to many poskim who said that what they'll do in some of the Eruvin is that they'll set off the Karpeif by Tzuras HaPesach, and they'll rely on many kulos in the Tzuras HaPesach that they use to set off the Karpeif, because, right, between the two, right, they've set off the Karpeif from the rest of the city with, right, Tzuras HaPesach around it. So they relied on some kulos, but worst comes to worst, they can have the Dvar Shmuel at the end, right? So you will find some sort of poskim will say, look, we're not going to just validate a city Eruv which has a Karpeif straight, but we will set off the Tzuras HaPesach, well, the Karpeif with Tzuras HaPesach and rely on some kulos for that, and that'll be fine because, you know, yeah. Yeah. Noam, you have a question? Your sound's not on. Your sound's not on. Or I just don't hear you. Now I can't hear. Wait, now I can't. Okay, I see multiple people talking and I don't hear anything.
Can you hear me talking?
Now I can hear you. Yeah. Now I can't hear you. You turned your sound off again. Now your sound's on.
Noam, try one more time.
No.
Could be your mic.
Oh, 1 second. Oh. How about now?
Now I can hear you.
Oh, the earphone. How about every part of the heart at that size?
Ah. So are you okay? Good. So. Right, so now, the question of defining what exactly a Karpeif is, so the Gemara distinguishes, right, basically, right, the Gemara is, right, the way the Gemara puts it is that you have, Were you still talking? Now I've lost you again. Or you turned off your sound now?
Yeah, you're good. You're good.
Okay. Yeah. So, okay. So, assuming we don't rely on the Dvar Shmuel, so how do we define? Right. So, how are we going to define the Karpev? So, one second. Let me just get this here. What is this? Okay. So the Gemara distinguishes between, this is on Chav Gimel Amud Beis, between an area that's planted with trees and one that's planted with vegetation. The reason is, Rashi says that if it has trees, that doesn't invalidate it, because it is a makom dira, because people plant trees so they can walk them, right? They can walk through it. So if you have like a park with trees, that's fine. It's not a karpef, right? That's not considered an uninhabited area, right? This is the Gemara, again, Chav Gimel Amud Beis. Now, many poskim, now this is a kula that I think has a lot more traction than the Dvar Shmuel by himself, is many poskim argue, the Minchas Yitzchak says this in Chelek Hesim and Kuf Ches, Ramoshe said this al peh, which was, even though the Gemara says that a karpev is any place with Zraim, so ostensibly a place with flowers, a botanical garden or something like that, would not fit the Gemara's definition would fit the Gemara's definition of a karpef and therefore invalidate an eruv. Ramosha argued that's not true, right? Meaning the difference really isn't between trees and, you know, flowers and plants. The difference is between a space that people look at and say this is where people live and hang out and relax, and a place where they look at it and say this is an uninhabited space. In the time of the Gemara, a place with trees you hung out in, right? You walked through a pardes, you walked through an orchard, you didn't walk through a place that just had zraim. In modern times, right, Ramosha, again, this is the argument, they have this in the Laws of Meir on page 62. They quote this al-peh from Ramosha, that this, and the chen amad davar, right, this is the minag. They say, look, parks, even if they're, or a botanical garden, right, maybe you look at the Gemara, it seems like it fits the definition of a karpef, but it doesn't, right? Meaning, we planted them so that we could walk through them, right? That's considered a makom dira. I mean, the feeling I get from any of the Erevin Svarim that I look at, or any Erev you look at, is that despite the fact that parks are bigger, parks, which are planted, you know, in that way and built in that way for people to hang out in, poskim assume is not a karpef. That is ladira, right? It doesn't have to be a place where people live. It has to be a place which is part of normal normal habitation. You get bigger problems with, right, they had a problem with this in the Heights. This is one of the things people didn't like about the Heights Eruv, is, I'm not sure what it was exactly, but I think it was like a zoning issue, right? Like, you know, you have these, like, random areas that just fall through the cracks, that are just, you know, random, big, open areas that, right, I don't know, there's old construction material just sitting there, right? A construction project failed, right? And it's just in the middle and it's uninhabited and it's an eyesore, right? Those are the types of things that are really, really problematic for Karpev, right? Parks, poskim assume, parks are parks, right? They're meant to be part of inhabitation. Yeah. Now, I'll just quickly read you from...
There are many people who live in the park, so even...
in Achinami. I'll read you quickly, because I think they have a nice little just summary of it from the Laws of an Erev book, where they have a practical summary of how cities deal with this. Because like I said, right, this is one of those things, you look around, you walk through Erev, and you see these all the time. So they write like this. They write, many citywide Erevin include areas such as swampland or overgrown areas. These areas are difficult to walk through and are similar to the case of a planted field in the Gemara. So let's examine some of the possible justifications for allowing such areas within a citywide Erev. So the first is the Rush, right? The Rush in Perek Beisim and Beis of Erevin suggests that perhaps the case of Karpef mentioned in the Gemara refers only to an area that is for the most part a field, but also contains a small residence. A field of this type, when planted with a large amount of vegetation, will appear like an uninhabited area. However, a courtyard or a city that is well inhabited will always maintain this appearance, even if there is some smaller area of vegetation within its confines. Now, the Rush does not issue a conclusive ruling, and his opinion is not quoted in Shulchan Aruch. Baruch. Therefore, it's questionable if this opinion can be relied on. The Dvar Shmuel writes that the restriction of carrying within a karpev does not apply to a karpev located in a city. He reasons that any natural uninhabited space situated in the city is obviously necessary and vital to the city, or those establishing the city would not have left it there, which I'm not sure is true, as I mentioned, right? Sometimes it's just like a fluke of zoning issues. Ramosha Feinstein did not feel that this rationale would apply in modern-day cities, as I mentioned. In the present-day, cities are not surrounded by walls, and wooded areas with vegetation are not deliberately placed within a city. Their location within a city is purely coincidental. Rabbi Yashiv shared similar reservations, and he viewed a karpev situated within a city as problematic and required it to be isolated from the rest of the city when constructing an eruv. Nevertheless, he felt that an eruv should be constructed even if isolating the karpevos within the city is impossible, because an eruv will prevent people from carrying without any partitions, which is a more severe transgression, right? So there are poskim, like Rabbi Yashiv, who say, look, I don't love the Dvar Shmuel, but I'll build an Eruv if I have to rely on the Dvar Shmuel, because at least that lowers it to a Dirabanan, and lowers the issue. So you will have post... Again, he's not comfortable with it, but he argued at least that, you know, even if you couldn't build an Eruv without Karpef, maybe there's room to build one, at least to lower the potential issue involved. And this, they quote from a Rabbi Rosner who heard it from Rebbe Yashiv. Again, I said, they have a lot of these Alpem Misoros that are very, very helpful. A third Heter, they write, Shulchan Aruch clearly states that streams and bodies of water negate the residential status of an area, right? Another one is water, right? Water is another example of a Karpef-like issue. However, according to Shulchan Aruch, this applies only if they are more than 10 Tvachim deep and are not fit for drinking, right? In the time of the Gemara, water was not a karpef, right? Not an invalidating karpef if you could drink from it, because people drank from it. However, here at Katz Lachomra, that Ramoshe maintained that at present people don't walk through water, even if it's less than 10 tvachim deep, and therefore, right, in time of the Gemara, shallow water people walk through, they drank from. Ramoshe argued that's not true, right? You have to look at this b'metzios. Nowadays, right, a shallow, right, random pool of water is uninhabited, right? No one's walking through that, no one's drinking from it, though he does note, if it really could be used for drinking or washing, then maybe you could be make ill. But he argues that, right, you have, on the one hand, you have the kula of parks, right, that we mentioned before, right, then time of the Gemara, people didn't really sort of hang out in, right, where there were just flowers. Nowadays they do, so post-Gemara make ill. Ramosha argued by the same token, while shallow water in the time of the Gemara was totally normal for an inhabited area, nowadays, right, people would avoid that area, right? So, right, many of the poskim have this sort of common sense view of karpef, which is, what type of thing do people actually normally use and inhabit within space that's not a karpef? Something that they don't is a karpef, even if it's the opposite of what, in the time of the Gemara, would have been an invalidating area. Now, they just finish here that according to Gaon Rav Moshe Feinstein, recreational parks are not karpefos, and the trees and ponds within the parks are not karpefos, as they enhance the appearance of the park, right? Right. Again, this is Rav Moshe's sort of common sense view, right? A park, even with a pond, even with trees, even with plants, even with a botanical garden, all of that is normal for a society. He also maintained that streams that are used for swimming or wading during the summer are not categorized as karpefos, even in the winter, right? This is a Masorah from Rabbi Heinemann in the name of Ramosha. Ramosha maintained that cemeteries are karpefos, even if they're visited regularly, as they are primarily designated to service the deceased and not the living. However, Rabbi Yashiv, they quote in the footnote, was makil on cemeteries, right? So you have all these borderline cases, and his argument was that, look, you may not live in a cemetery, but living people visit their deceased relatives, right? That's something you have in civilized places, and they go and they daven and they do whatever they do in cemeteries. So Ramosha was machmir, Rabbi Yashiv was zmekel. Then they just finish off, this is their last paragraph. In reality, most city Erevin have at least one karpef or questionable karpef located within their confines. Segregating all the Carpathos from the rest of the city often involves prohibitive costs. If possible, paths should be made through the Carpathos at regular intervals, right, because that would make it inhabited. This can effectively split one large Carpath into multiple small Carpathos, each one smaller than a base of Siam. Alternatively, some posts can allow the use of certain questionable tsuros haPesach, such as tachuv, right, even if they don't like tachuv in general, in order to isolate a karpef. If this is not possible...
Zirin, we lost you.
You lost me?
Yeah, but Zirin.
Yeah, I hear you. Can you hear me?
We just lost you for a second. Now we can.
Okay. So again, they say most Erevin... Most cities have some sort of carpave or questionable carpave. They say the best thing is obviously to cut it in half, right? Put paths through it, which make it usable, which cut the carpave into multiple small carpathos, each of them less than the base of Siam. Alternatively, you can isolate the carpave with the Tzuros haPesach, and they note that many poskim are willing to be makil on Tzuros, what Tzuros haPesach you use. So they quote here that Rabbi Miller in Toronto, he doesn't use tachov for the city Erev, but he will use tachov to isolate Carpathos. Because he thinks Mikra din tachov is fine, he'd rather be machmir on tachov, but, you know, he'll use tachov, right? So for the city itself, he won't rely on tachov, but to isolate the Carpathos, he will rely on tachov. But they know that Reb David Feinstein didn't like this, right? So again, you have these, right? Some poskim will take sort of these middle positions. Their last sentence is, if this is not possible, there may be other mitigating factors to permit the Carpath, such as occasional recreational use, or some aesthetic or practical function, etc. So, like I said, there's a lot more to say in Carpath, but I really wanted to give you the really, really, really quick rundown of it. But Pachot Yoter, right, Chazal didn't like uninhabited areas. Building city Erevin are really, really hard with any Carpath. The methods that poskim used to be makel are either push comes to shove, they rely on the Dvar Shmuel, right? That was Rabbi Yashiv, right? Even if I had to rely on the Dvar Shmuel, I would, because either you can rely on the Dvar Shmuel, or at least it lowers the Isser that people are doing. But most poskim don't like the Dvar Shmuel by itself. The second group of heterim is to try to understand something not as a Carpath, right? The way Ramosha does, and says, look, parks, ponds, and that type of thing, by the Gemara standards, are a Carpath, but, you know, a park is clearly not a Carpath lemaisa, in our societies. That's not going to help you for everything, right? An abandoned work zone is going to be a Carpath, however you do it. There, the best thing to do is to isolate the Carpath with Tzuros haPesach, because it cuts it out from the rest of the Eruv. And as you saw, Ryan Miller thought you could, or David Feinstein that you couldn't, rely on maybe more makil shitos of Tzuros haPesach, a sort of a tseruf of different shitos to isolate the Carpe from the society, from the rest of the Erev. I've heard this from many people who build Erevin, though, right? And they attest to it here in basically any book on Erevin. Carpe is just one of those things that is really hard. You walk through a big city, right, there are going to be places that are uninhabited, right, and even if you use every kula in the book and say, well, a park is, even, some of them are more plausible than others, right, parks, I'm willing to buy Ramosha easily, right, that's not a Carpath, that's a place that's meant to be inhabited, but unless you're willing to rely straight on the Dvar Shmuel, looking around for Carpathos is a problem, especially in big Erevin. And like I said, this causes some of the biggest machlokot. I remember in the Heights, right? This was one of the main reasons that people, right, leaving aside Rishus HaRabim and etc. in Manhattan, right? There was a very clear, uninhabited, former abandoned work zone in the middle of the not on the YU side, on the Breuer side of the Erev, and there were a lot of people who didn't rely on the Erev at all because they felt this was an invalidating Carpath. And that's the problem with the Carpath, is if you have one that's not isolated from the rest of the Erev, unless you possibly the Dvar Shmuel, it invalidates the entire Erev. So this is one of the practical things that people who build Erevin really, really, really worry about. This is something you should ask whoever's coming on for your practical Erevin, how they deal with it. different places are bigger problems. You know, if you're talking about Jachter, you know, I saw him in Sharon, right? Sharon is very, very rural, right? You're talking about forest. You're talking about ponds and swamps and, you know, God knows what. But even in, you know, like I said, even Manhattan, right, you'll have abandoned work zones.
You said one thing. One of the issues that often comes up that a rabbi can be aware of, even if you don't fill the narrative, is really the carpet issue. I know someone who became an assistant rabbi in a community, and he realized that the Eruv, which Kilo had this hechsher of this very big rabbi who made it. So, you know, Mitzias changed as far as carpes was concerned, you know, and it became areas that, you know, construction zones, etc., which this rabbi itself, even if you make a heter for, this rabbi itself, when he called him up and he said, are you aware that this is in your Eruv? And he was beside himself that people are ki'ilu being makelan in Eruv that he did build, but that Mitzias was not there when he built it. So it's another thing to be aware of in terms of the practical
issue. Yeah, I'll just note, by the way, that, you know, the hetzer that I mentioned from Moshe Feinstein, right, that a place which has Zraim, right, which in the time of the Gemara would have been would have been a karpef. And nowadays is not. He's not the first person to say it. It does appear in the Meiri on Daf Chav Dalet Amud Aleph. Right, the Meiri writes that Mikol Makom Yeralisha Zrayim Hasuyim LeTiul VeLatzeit LeSham Tamid LeTayel Sham LaHariach Ein Elu Mevadlot Mechitzot. Right. So this is not like a new thing. Right. It happens to be that, you know, I assume that public funded parks were less common in the time of the Gemara or even the Meiri than they are in our planned cities. But this is not like it's not like modern poskim pulled it out of nowhere. It's just that the metzias changed, right? That, you know, it used to be a place that just had random, you know, flowers growing. Was not a place where people walked around. They walked under trees. Nowadays, people, you know, have botanical gardens. That's just a reality. But the Meiri, right? This heter does already appear in the Meiri. Again, some of the machlokot you'll get. You know, halavai, this is the only machlokas you have, or like, you know, swimming pools or ponds that people swim in and things like that. Right, but these are the type of things that come up a lot. So that's, in a nutshell, the issue of Karpef. We're going in hour six, so let me try to give a 10-15 minute summary of Eruv Chatzeres and Sechiras Rishus, which it deserves a lot more than that, but let's give a very quick summary of it. Okay, so all of this is about the structure of an Eruv, right? We've dealt with Rosh Yachid, Rosh Arabim, Karpev, Carmel, etc., 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 Zerza Pesach. Once you have all the structure in place, are you losing me? Can you hear me? Okay, I saw my internet went out for a second, but I think it's back, right? Back? Can you hear me? Yeah?
We just missed you for a second.
Okay, I was just asking you if you could hear me because I saw the internet went out. Okay, so very, very, very quickly. Because the point of one of the points of Erevin was to make sure that there didn't become a blurring of lines between Rishus HaYachin and Rishus HaRabim, right? That people wouldn't get used to carrying from a house into a chatzar and a chatzar into a mavui, and then end up carrying from a mavui into a Rishus HaRabim. Chazal required that you, right, all the Rishuyos HaYachid within this space that you're carrying, that you have an Eruv Chatzeros / Rishutov Mavaos, right? Eruv Chatzeros, right, for... Combining everyone in a chatzer, shitov mavos, combining different mavot, people in different chatzeres into a mavoi, different mavos. They required combining them by having shared food, which made it feel like it's one big rishus hayachid, because that was part of Chazal's way of making sure that you understood that when you carry from a house into a chatzer, it's not because you're allowed to carry from a more private space into a public space, and you'll end up carrying from a chatzer or a mavi into rishus harabim, but because these are all rishus hayachid. And the way we did that was by creating this fictitious combination, right, where it's as if you live in the same house as everybody within your space by having shared food in the chatzer and the mavui, right? That's the nutshell version of the logic of Eruv Erev Chatzeros. And you, right, so you need to take food, practically, right, unless you're, right, if you have, you know, a small group, so then you need food for each person, but then there's a, right, once you have a large group, so, then you just need, 1 second, let me just make sure I get you the main issues that you need here. Kriyat Shem Bayit, Kriyat Shem Chatzer. Yeah. Okay, right, so the Gemara in Erev and Daf Pei says that, right, once you have a lot of people, you need Mazon Shnei Sudos total. Right? If you have a small group, you need a grogeris for each. Once you have a big group, you need shir stay sudos. Practically, what that means in most Erevin is that they have a box of matzah that they put in the shul, which we'll get to in just a moment. We should just point out that that food is actually owned by the community, right? This is actually joint food. You have to be mezaket. There's all types of questions exactly how to be mezaket, but practically, right, you know, the rabbi will go in with someone else in shul, hand it to him, he'll pick it up and be mezaket on behalf of the, right, on behalf of the community. But the whole community really owns that matzah, right? Ray Schwartz told me that at some point a woman came to him and she forgot to buy challah for Shabbos, and came to him on Shabbos for emergency challah, and he just told her, look, right, go to the Erev, right, take the box of matzos and take a few matzos because it belongs to everybody. You have a right to it, and whatever, he'll replace it later if it goes under the shear. Right, it's not a big deal. They really do own it. Right, this is joint ownership of food, and that is right. There are all types of interesting issues. Right, what do you do if you're making it an Erev of Pesach? Right, now, right, you can't use chametz, you can't use matzah, right? I don't want to get into all those. There are all types of interesting lumdish issues about this. But pachot yoter, that's the issue of right, of an Erev Chatzeros. That's what you're doing in a very, very, very quick nutshell. Now, the practical issues that you have are as follows. The Gemara says that you need, right, the Gemara has a machlokes, whether you need to put your Erev b'makom pita or b'makom, right, where you eat your food, right, b'makom pita, or whether you need, or b'makom lina, right, because it has to be, now we paskin, it has to be b'makom pita, right, we paskin like Rav. Now the Chazon Ish has a chiddush within that, who says that therefore that means that it actually has to be in the room, right? What it means is the room in the house where you eat, right? Not just a house where you eat, but the room in the house where you you eat. Therefore, he was mechadesh that you're actually allowed to carry without an Erev from, let's say, your bedroom into a chatzer without an Erev, right? You only can't carry from your dining room or your kitchen into that space, because those aren't makom dira, so they're not the primary rooms that are chayav in Erev. I don't know how many times this actually comes up, that you forgot to make an Erev and need to carry specifically from your bedroom into a chatzer, but that is the position of the Chazon Ish in Simen Sadi Os Mem Aleph. This is a big machlokas. The poskim don't necessarily accept it. But for practical purposes, the more important issue is that it's clear when you read the sugya in Ayin Beis, Ayin Gimel, is that an Erev, right, it's shared food, and therefore it needs to be in a space where people live. The problem is that most people don't put an Erev in where you live. They put the Erev in shul, right? Which is not a makom dira, it's not a makom shein, it's not a makom lina, it's not a makom pita, it's not a makom anything, right? It is a shul, and this has been the minag for a very long time, and this is a problem that poskim have been dealing with for a very long time, which is why we do this. So let me just give you 1 second. Right, so let me read this. So in Shulchan Aruch, right, it says this Shin Samach Vav Gimel Ve'ein Manichem Oso Bechatzer El Bayit Sheroi Ledira Lafuge Beisharach Sadrim Rupeset Vitzarech Shehei Bo Arbamos, etc. Now the Ramah writes in Shin Samach Vav Gimel, and he says Vaminog Bizmanazeh Lahaniach Ha'iruv Bebeis HaKnesses. Right, the Minog nowadays, or in time of the Ramah, to put it in Shul. V'chein Noagu HaKadmonim. Now he argues, why is this true? How do we defend this? It has to be a makom dira. So he argues, well, maybe that's only right. That's only for an eruv chatzeros. Our what we call an eruv is really a shituf mavos. And he says, v'nira li atam de eruvin shalonu yeshlem din shituf vein sarach laniach beveis dira. Right. So Rama argues that well, that's true of an eruv, but our eruv is not really an eruv. It's a shituf. And the Mishnah Brewer writes. In Simon Chavtes, if Khan Chavtes there, Ratzalomar, Afal Pisha Besagnez in a Roy Lidira, Mipnek Dushaso, Shere Adira, Humakom Ha'achil of Osir Lechel Besagnezes, and Loha Lomdim Sham, etc., Mikomakom Yishla Kaima Minag, Kemosha Messiah Be'erevin Shalonu, Yishlam Din Shitufe Mavos. Right, it's, and I'm skipping. She too famous. Mavos in Tzarich Lanicho Klal Beveis Dira Shei Makom Am Mishdamer Levad. So the right. So this is the minog. It's not clear that it's right. It's not so clear, but the minog already since the time of the Ramah is to put it in shuls. Right, I'm just running through a Simon's thing where he quotes all these positions who defend this minog. However, there are modern postgame who don't like it. The Rav Moshe Roth, he quotes, argues that even the Rama wouldn't like it bizman hazeh, because maybe the Rama only liked it when there was only one shul. Right, there was one central shul, so at least that one shul was potentially a shared space of the community that was in the confines of the Eruv. But nowadays, right, putting it in a shul is pretty random, right? You know, even by the Ramah standards. It's not the central shul, it's a shul, right, that happens to be within it. And therefore, he doesn't like it. Other postgame were not so worried about this, but lemaisa the minog is to put the eruv in shul, and like I said, you have to be mezake the eruv to the whole community. Right, that's the sugya in the Mishnah on Ayin Tes Amud Beis and the ensuing Gemara. Right, there's all types of interesting questions of who you can be mezake, you know, etc. One of the interesting questions that Poskim like talking about is, can you be mezake an Erev if there are people within the Erev who don't believe in Erevin and consider it a chova to them to have an Erev? Poskim in general are makil on this for a host of different reasons. It's a schus gamor, right? They don't really not like Erevin, etc. But you will see in some of the polemical literature on Erevin that certain people will say, oh, the Erev doesn't work because I don't like Erevin, and therefore I don't want you in Mizaka, and therefore I'm not part of the Erev, and I live within the Erev, and every single person in the Erev needs to be part of the Erev, and I invalidate it. And other Poskim who just think, you know, that's not how life that life works. Okay, this is right. Way too much of a summary, but Rav Regalacha. That's what an Erev Chatzeros is, right? It's this combined food in this shared space. Practically, the way most people do it is they are put it in the shul and they're mezaket, right? The rabbis mezaket through someone, and that's what they do. And most poskim, from what I gather, are not actually worried about this. The issue that you know, there are people in the Eruv who don't want an Eruv. They still mazak on their behalf. Very quickly, the bigger problem is non-Jews within the Eruv, where Right, basically the point of an Eruv is everyone needs to be in it, right? So all the Jews need to be in it, but you solve that by being mezaket to everybody in an Eruv, right? The Gemara has all types of interesting things, right? If someone forgot to join, can even mevatel, rishos, and the like, but this never happens in a normal city Eruv. It might happen in, like, your hotel Eruv or something like that, or your apartment building. And if that happens, I gave you makaros on bitl, rishos, and things like that. But practically, in a city Eruv, what you're talking about is the rabbi being mezaket, a box of matzah, and putting in the shul on behalf of the community. However, the other problem is that you don't have to just be worried about the Jews, you have to be worried about the non-Jews within the Eruv. Now, the way Chazal formulated it was that if you have one Jew, one non-Jew living in a chatzer, then it doesn't mess up the Eruv, because we assume that the Jew would be afraid to live with non-Jews, so he's not really going to stay there very long, so we have no reason to be goes there. But if you have two Jews, and then a non-Jew, so then we have a gzera, that you need to be socher rishus, right? You need to rent the space from the non-Jew, because Chazal wanted to discourage Jews from non-Jews, Jews and non-Jews living together, and they assume once you had two Jews and one Jew in a chatzer, the Jews would be more likely to keep a permanent arrangement, and therefore they forced you to, if you want to carry there, to be socher rishus from the non-Jew in that space. Now that all works when you have like a little tiny, you know, Eruv with three people or five people or something like that. City Eruvin are a big problem because you got a lot of people in that city, and any one of them, if you aren't so chereshos, the non-Jew's presence in the Eruv will mess up the Eruv. So what do we do? So the Torah already says, right, don't think that you can just rent the city from the Sar Ha'ir. That doesn't work, right? You need to rent from each person individually. And the Beis Yosef writes, the reason is, the Beis Yosef writes, that clarifies that what the Torah means is only in a city where the Tsar isn't, this is not like a Polish fiefdom, right, where he really owns, right, the city is really a private domain, right, there it would work, because, you know, the Tsar Ha'ir literally owns the city. But he argues that what doesn't work is like an elected official who doesn't actually own the houses, right, and he can't. And therefore the Beis Yosef, right, that's why the Tur doesn't like this Rishus. But the Beis Yosef himself says that if you have a city where the Tzar Chayir and Nazim El Alpi HaMelech Vassar Vanaga, so Alpi HaMamunim Shalahem, if the government officials have really strong control over the city and everything in the city happens based on their rishus. So then he argues that it would work, especially if the head of the city, the head of the government, has the right to put either soldiers or property within people's private property, or he has the right to kick people out of their houses. Obviously in modern Eruvin, right, it becomes important to figure out whether our Sar Ha'ir, based on the Beis Yosef's understanding, is like the one that doesn't work of the tour, right, or the one that the Beis Yosef assumes does work, where they have they really have control over the city in an extreme or at least a meaningful way. The problem basically is as follows. The Svara of the Beis Yosef of Yochel Salkam is from the Rivash and Shuba Tav Chav Zayin. Now, to give you the 1 minute summary of the Machlokot HaPoskim that you have, basically you have some Poskim who say, look, eminent domain, right? The fact that a Western government, if it wants to, can take your house to build a highway, proves that this is more like the Sarah Ha'ir of the Beis Yosef, because Yochel Asal came, right, he can kick you out of your house, and the like, and therefore you can just go to the mayor and you can rent the space, and that's sufficient. Or you can go to the police chief or the fire department, because if there's a fire in your house, they have the right to break down your door, and that's sufficient. Right? So that's one group of poskim. Other poskim say, what are you talking about? Eminent domain proves the opposite, right? Eminent domain proves that the government doesn't own your house. That's why they have to pay you for your house. Right? Right, so some poskim say, no, they own your house, they just have to compensate you. Other poskim say, no, they don't own your house, it's just that they're allowed to force you to sell. Right? And therefore, it doesn't work, right? Not the police officer, and not the not the police chief, and not the fire chief, and not the mayor. So that's basically the division you have in poskim. Now, certain poskim have a note, and this is like Rav Schechter's position. Personally, I think this is the most compelling. They say, well, you really have to distinguish between carrying into the non-Jews' houses within the Eruv, or carrying on the roads, right? So Rav Schechter says, look, if you're carrying on the roads, the government really does own the roads. They really do have the right to close the road if they want to kick you off the road. So when I rent it from the mayor, I rent it from the police chief or the fire department or whatever, but I'm only renting the roads, so that's meaningful. They really do own it or control it, at least in a legal sense. Private houses of non-Jews, it's not true they don't own it. So Rav Schechter, for example, says, yeah, you can rent it from the mayor, but you're in an Eruv, you're only allowed to carry either into the houses of Jews or in the streets, but you're never allowed to carry in an Eruv into the private house of a non-Jew, because the Sar Ha'ir has no right to rent it to you. On the other hand, certain other poskim who really do view this as more of the Beis Yosef Sar Ha'ir say it's not true. You're allowed to carry even into the private domain. I've seen basically a divide in this, right? A lot of poskim are like of the Rav Schechter camp, who say, look, the Torah says you can't just rent from the Sar Ha'ir. The Beis Yosef says you only can if the Sar Ha'ir has control over people's private houses, can kick them out of their house, can quarter, you know, soldiers in their house. That's not what we live in. But the roads are really controlled by the government. So you can go to the mayor and rent it, and that's perfectly legitimate to carry either in the Jewish houses or in the streets. You just aren't allowed to carry into private rishuyos. And then you have these group of poskim who really take a sort of a dachuk view and say, look, you know, because of eminent domain, or because of the ability of the police or to enter your house with a warrant, or the fire chief to enter your house with when there's a fire, you can even enter into the private domain of the non-Jews. My personal feeling of the sugya is that, you know, the svara to say you're allowed to carry in the street is very, very strong, right? The svara to say that you're allowed to carry in the private domain, and that a modern American society with eminent domain is the Beis Yosef's totally controlling government and not the tours you aren't allowed to rent from the Sar Ha'ir, I find less compelling. And therefore, right, I personally find the svara to say that you can rent from the mayor and allow carrying in the street to be very compelling. The svara to say that eminent domain proves that the mayor owns people's private houses and therefore I can carry into the non-Jew's home, I find less compelling, but there are many people who do think it is compelling. Sometimes you get sort of weird cases, right? Schechter notes that when they built the D.C. Eruv, right? Washington, D.C. is weird because it's not a state, and therefore it's under direct control of the federal government. So there was a suffix whether you had to rent it from the mayor of D.C. or from the president. So they did it from both, to build the Washington, D.C. Eruv. So you do get sort of interesting cases like that. I get the feeling that most Eruvin try to rent from the mayor. In some Eruvin, you do get this, you do use these svaros of the police chief or the fire chief. In the case where you do have a bigger question, is in apartments. Let's say you're not building a community Eruv, you're just building apartment building or a hotel Eruv. There is a much more discussion in the postgame of whether the superintendent can give you rishus, because the superintendent you know, might be allowed to enter into people's apartments, or might be allowed to keep his, you know, he might own the air conditioner, let's say, or in certain, definitely in Europe, where you have apartment buildings where they're pre-furnished, right? Unlike American apartments, right? The superintendent may actually have control over the light fixtures or the tables even or the couches or things like that. So there is much more discussion in post-skim that even if you don't buy the Sarayir can allow you to carry even within the people's houses, a superintendent might own the apartment building enough to let you carry into the private residence of non-Jews. Other poskim say no, a superintendent just takes care of it. He can give you permission to carry in the hallways, but not into people's private issues. You have similar issues in hotels. Right, what do you do in hotels, right? Can the hotel manager there, he really does own things that are within the rooms, right? You know, he owns the beds, he owns everything. So there is much more of a svara to say that a hotel manager can give you the right to carry in, if you have an Eruv Chatzeros and you do schiros from him, to carry into people's private rooms. He can definitely give you permission to carry in the hallways. So these are the different manifestations. The last point I'll just mention is that this all works for non-Jews. The biggest problem is that the poskim deal with is schiros rishos from non-religious Jews, where they seem to fall through the cracks. Right, they're not in bittul rishos because they aren't going to be involved in rishos. They don't know they're part of the eruv, are against the eruv, etc. But the schiros rishos may not work for them because that seems to have been a takana for non-Jews, not for non-religious Jews. And the poskim try to deal with that issue of whether you can use schiros rishos there or that's a mixing of takanot. So this last half hour was a bit more rushed than I'd like, but know that those are just some of the practical issues that you get. Like I said, practically most Erevin, that's what you're talking about. You're talking about an Erev Chatzeros being made by a rabbi, put in the shul, despite all the conceptual problems with that, and they're mezaka on behalf of the community. And then they do schiros rishos from either the mayor, the police chief, or the fire chief, which again, the poskim divide on whether that actually permits carrying into the private domain of non-Jews, or, according to many poskim, it allows you to carry within the public spaces, the roads, and the things like that, because there the government really does have control, but they're much more hesitant about private domains, and then you get similar machlokot with varying levels of nuance in superintendents and apartment buildings and hotel managers and the like, where things are a bit more murky. But those are at least some of the issues that you'll see in Erevin, and there, like I said, there's a divide in each one of these issues, and Erev Chatzeros especially did not give you at all, I was not at all fair to the sugya, but for practical purposes, that's what happens, right? There's not much more to know about it than that. Obviously, there are a lot of sugya issues and fascinating issues, but that's the sort of the practical bottom line of what you're talking about in building an Erev. There's a reason that, like in these books, the Laws of Erev book, the amount of space they actually devote to Erev Chatzeros component of it is minimal, because while the sugyos are long, practically, right, you know, the minhag has just been what the Rama says. You rent it, you know, put it in the shul, and a mizaka box of matzah. So, like, it's not like a... Right, halacha l'maisa, you know, like all the fascinating sugyas of katan and can you be mezakeh through your own wife or does she not have a yad and all those sugyas, like they just don't come up, right? The rabbi of the shul just grabs someone from shul and is mezakeh at them, right? There's no like, right, they don't get into all those sugyot usually. Okay, that's the...
If people make eruvin, if you're in a community that doesn't have a big and people make smaller eruvin, so those things come up. I mean, people who make an Eruv in their backyard or make an Eruv on their street, which, you know, will happen in places.
Yeah, that will happen, right? Or if you do it in your own apartment building, right, in a place you don't have an Eruv, or you do it in a hotel, that's when these things really do come up.
A hotel might not need an Eruv altogether.
Right, that might need it because he owns property. That was something I could not get into, right? You might not need an hotel because he owns property everywhere.
The sheet that you had, Kavana for Eruv Chatzeros, what was on that? On that Makoro sheet.
What did I send you? Let me look at what I was on that. Oh, that was right. That was right. There's a bit of a discussion in post-skim of what happens if you have. you actually have joint food and things like that, right? It's not that you made an Eruv, but you actually have joint food for one reason or another. Does that count, right? Whatever. You know,
if you have a... Or a kibbutz, if you have a...
Kibbutz, you're all eating at a catered event over Shabbos or something like that, right? Like, you bought food together, things like that. Does that count as the Eruv, or do you actually need to have kavana for the Eruv? It's an interesting conceptual question, but like I said, when you're making the Eruv, it's not the issue. That's like a post-facto question, like, right? We forgot to be mishtate food, but we are having a potluck meal, so we all co-own, right, things like that. Again, that doesn't come up in a city Eruv. That comes up in, like, you know, you all rented, like, I don't know, you know, it happens in an apartment building. It happens in, a bunch of families came together and rented, you know, in a floor of an apartment building, for Shabbos, right? Something like that. I don't know.
Okay. Yashar Koach, Rabbi Zirin.
Okay. Shkoyach, enjoy your summer and the rest of your Limud and Erevin. If you want, like I said, if you want more Makaros, there's, you know, you can look online under my series in Eruv, or Simon has all his packets on his Eruv thing, so anything you want to look at, right, he has his packets, which are basically his book, but in source packets, so if you want to look up any source, you can really look there, or you can look at, you know, Zilberman, it goes more in depth in his series, but this is just sort of everything in a nutshell, so... Anyways, guys, I'll talk to you later.
Okay, so we will speak, Yiddish.